Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Interim Committee meeting, August 21st. And we will have the clerk take the roll.
Chairman Damshin, committee here. Members, the roll, I'm the committee counsel, not the
you
clerk.
You are.
Yeah. That's what kind of took me back a bit.
I'm sorry. We can start over.
Okay. Now, roll call. Representatives Damshin.
Here. I want to be sure.
Anderson.
Here.
Brandenburg. DeCray.
Here.
Grubdahl. Hansen.
Here.
Hofstede. Hunsker.
Here.
Kelsch. Nathy.
Here.
Rust.
Here.
Steiner.
Here.
Senators Freeburg. Bowman.
Here.
Burkhardt.
Here.
Herbley.
Here.
Larson. Murphy.
Here.
Triplett.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you, counsel. I'll try to be correct on my address.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that we approve the minutes.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved as mailed out previously. And I apologize for calling you the clerk. I'm thinking my mind is really on harvest. Council, note that Representative Brandenburg is present. Well, thank you all for coming this morning, and we're going to start right off with our 10-10 item on the agenda, presentation by Mr. Terry Steinwand, Director of the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Is this on, Tim? Can you hear me? Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Terry Steinwand. I'm the Director of the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. The goose sticks that you passed around are a result of the high Canada goose population that we have across the state. Hopefully you enjoy them. If you put enough spice in anything, you can eat it, I guarantee you. So I just want to provide a general overview, and I guess before I do start, I want to recognize Mike Johnson. He's our senior waterfall biologist, and he actually did the survey and put together the report that's in front of you, and I'm just going to give a summary. So if there are any technical questions, I would probably ask Mike to respond to those. As you can see from the graph that I passed out here, our resident goose population is high, and there are certainly some ag producers that are experiencing depredation of crops as a result. And early fall Canada goose seasons have been held in North Dakota since 1999 in an effort to reduce those numbers. Sargent and Richland counties were the first to be included in what used to be called the early September Canada goose season, This first early season was held for the first 2 weeks of September, but also counted against the total days allowed for hunting of Canada geese in North Dakota by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that number of days is 107 days. We can't change that, and we have to move around. If we take early days, we have to take it away from the end of the season or somewhere. As an example, this year, we have what's called the Missouri River Zone for the early season. It stops a week earlier than every place else during the early season, but we add that, for that area, we add 7 days on to the end because it's along the Missouri River Corridor, and actually Canada geese stick around there, and it's an attempt to get a higher harvest on those geese. Like I said, 2 weeks normally had to be cut from the regular season normally at the end, and we have urged the Fish and Wildlife Service for even more tools to allow hunters to help in control of the expanding population of Canada geese. And actually, back in 2001, 2, somewhere in there, 2003, the Fish and Wildlife started an environmental impact statement to see what the result of that would be. In the early stages of the early Canada goose season, any days in the early season was included in the 14-day limitation for non-resident waterfowl hunters. In 2003, the legislature, you folks, passed a law that exempted non-resident hunters that hunted geese in Sargent and Richland counties from having to use some of their 14 days for hunting waterfowl. In 2008, the EIS that I just referenced, Fish and Wildlife Service completed it, and we were able to allow Canada goose hunting in August without counting against any allocation of those 107 days. And the August portion of the season isn't technically considered season, it's considered a conservation order, which is the reason we can do that. During the last session, the legislature, again you folks, added Benson, Ramsey, and Towner counties to the 14-day limit exclusion and required this report that I put in front of you, which I'll summarize. Season dates for the 2011 Canada goose season were from August 13th through September 15th. We could have actually had a season as early as August 1st, but we took it out to statewide meetings, and it was pretty much a consensus. Hunters didn't want it, producers didn't want it. Hunters thought it was too early to get in the season. Producers thought it was too early because the crops weren't off yet. This year might be a little bit of an anomaly, but I don't think too much. So we decided the middle of August, and actually it starts August 15th, and it's been going on for a few days. The daily bag limit in 2011 was 8, and possession limit was 16. This was up from 5 and 10 in 2010. In the past, we've measured hunters, hunter activity, and harvest for the early season since 2000, but the August portion only since 2008, because that's when we were allowed to go in the August portion. Up to this year, we didn't separate resident and non-resident activity. We just wanted to look at total activity, total harvest. And a sample for this survey was taken with what's called the Harvest Information Program, and I'll refer to it as HIP, which every waterfowl hunter is required to register with if you want to hunt waterfowl, and not just North Dakota, nationwide. For this survey, we took the number of resident and non-resident hunters that had HIP registered by September 15th of 2011 and chose a random sample of about 15%, which amounted to 3,045 residents and 455 non-residents, and surveys were sent out to those individuals. I'm going to give a lot of numbers here, so hopefully, I have a tough time keeping track of them, so if you have any questions, don't hesitate. It's estimated that 4,615 residents and 560 non-residents actively hunted during the 2011 early Canada goose season. And from the survey, residents hunted in 46 counties, while non-residents hunted in 14 counties. And more detailed results are shown in the tables that are in the report, the larger report that you have. We estimated that 48,711 geese were harvested in the early Canada goose season, 43,612 from residents, and 5,099 from non-residents. And we estimated that 315 non-resident hunters hunted in the day-exempt counties, those five counties referenced earlier, and the average days hunted per active hunters was 3.32 days per resident and 4.05 days per non-resident. Ramsey County had the highest total harvest resident and non-resident, with 8,046 birds, followed by Sargent with 5,427, and McIntosh County with 3,012 birds. And Table 3 shows a breakdown by county. It's estimated that Canada goose harvest by non-residents in the day-exempt counties, again, that's Sargent, Richland, Benson, Ramsey, and Towner, was 3,273 birds, and that was led by Sargent County with 1,921, Richland with 818, and Ramsey County with 534. These three counties were the highest three counties for non-resident hunters and totaled 70.2% of the harvest by non-resident hunters, but only 6.7% of the estimated harvest for the entire state. Keep in mind that all these numbers that I've thrown around are only estimates, and we think non-resident hunters may have harvested geese in Benson and Towner counties, but weren't sampled in the process. It's really difficult to draw conclusions on 1 year's worth of data, since we've never separated the resident and non-resident before, and even better estimates would require us to have a larger sample size. And the HIP database wasn't really designed for sampling early Canada goose season, so we think we need a better way, if we want better information, to obtain a name and address database of non-resident early Canada goose hunters to get better estimates than what we have here. And stand for any questions.
Sorry about that, committee. Any questions for Representative Nathan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, the harvest of 48,000 plus, is, in your estimation, is that enough, too much, or too little, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathan, I would defer to my waterfall expert on that. My personal opinion, not biologically based, is probably not enough. Given, again, you look at that graph, we're, I think we have a goal of around 80,000 pairs or individuals. 80,000 individuals, we're at 415,000 right now. That's way above goal, so 48,000, probably not enough. And these are resident geese. I mean, ones that are, that nest in the state, raise broods in the state, so on and so forth. So we'd always have to be a little careful, but again, better information would tell us that. My personal estimate is no, it's probably not enough at this point.
Representative Brandenburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, so I understand there's five counties now that doesn't count against the 14-day restriction, but they're down there in the south central part of the state where none of them are within the five counties, and we're kind of like a mini devil's lake, really. And I've had a lot of farmers that have called and have a lot of trouble with soybeans, especially taking out a number of acres, and I've had some too where they've taken out. Only trouble is right now those birds are big and they got the soybeans. I mean, there's, but why can't we expand that to more of the state than just the five counties? Because there's going to be some frustration out there. I'm here, and I haven't heard much of, you know, I hear a few things, but I haven't heard a lot about any meeting I go to, any ag meeting, or I can't even go to the C-Store, and they're talking about the depredation from the soybean, because there's going to be a lot. I'm not talking an acre or two, I'm talking, I've seen fields with 10 acres plus taken out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brandenburg, I can appreciate not being able to go to the C-Store and not getting questions on something that happens all the time. I think that is a very legitimate and a very important question to be asked right now. I know Senator Erbily, and I'll answer his question right now because I wanted him to ask it in front of the whole crowd, is we do have methods or tools that we can use to try to reduce or avoid those depredations. One of them is what's called a depredation kill permit. We have to go through, we get a permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service where we can administer those. We go through Wildlife Services, which we pay separately from what the legislature gives them to operate. And it allows an individual producer to kill up to 25 geese off of that permit, and they can get multiple permits. Sometimes that doesn't always work. Some other things we do is we actually provide snow fence, because when they have that visual, that sight line towards a soybean field or a durum field or whatever it might be, that's where they're going to go. If you can put some impediment there, whether it's cattails and in this case a snow fence, they aren't able to get there, and if it gets something, you allow that shoreline vegetation to grow up, they don't go there anymore. Now, will you still have some problems? Probably some. Other things, use propane cannons, coyote decoys. And some people say, why coyote decoys? Don't we have enough coyotes out there? Well, evidently not. Flags and kites, what's called a solar scarecrow, which has had limited success. A spray, which is called flock buster, which can be used on wheat and beans. It's a little expensive, but it looks, this is the first year we've used it, and it looks like it does have some potential probability. Grass planting, CRP buffer strips, food plots, where we actually agreed to pay the landowner up to X amount of acres, and if the geese eats the crop, we pay. If they don't eat, we don't pay, and they can harvest. That has to happen in the spring of the year before, and so on and so forth. But the second part of your question is, why can't your counties be included? We don't see why statewide couldn't be included. With the burgeoning goose population, we don't know why it couldn't be statewide.
Continue.
And I do know you guys are making these efforts, and some of them are working. A lot of times, and I compliment you for that, but a lot of times what happens when you're farming, you know, you're out there, you're taking care of your crops, you're so busy, you don't have time to go out there and take care of those geese. You're spraying the field, you come over here and using ducks and geese, you know, and then they can't fly yet, you know, but boy, you ought to watch about 50 of them head to the water. It's actually kind of funny when they head to the water zone, because they can't fly, but they waddle, and the adults don't fly either, they won't leave them, so it guys, you have a picture, I'm sure you've seen it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, not necessarily a response. It's an issue like yours, and people need to allow, or landowners need to allow people in to hunt them too, because they do have a homing instinct, and if they'll come back to the same general area, if you start shooting them down, you don't want to move them onto somebody else's crop. But our goal is to have the harvest, or the hunters, help get that goose population down.
Senator Eberle.
Thank you, Chairman and Terry. Just a couple other follow-up questions. You answered quite a few of them. I don't have the problem going to the feed store, but church is becoming a real issue for me. Could you expand just a little bit on the kill permits? What are some of the rules and regulations on the kill permit? The type of shots you can use, and distance and stuff like that. And also on the spray portion, do you provide the cost of the chemical to put down? I forgot what you call it again.
Mr. Chairman, plot, Senator yeah. Eberle, I'm going to ask Mike. He actually administers those permits. I do not believe we pay for the spray on that, and it's like $125 per 5 gallons, and it takes multiple applications. But in terms of the kill permits, I'd ask Mike to respond to that.
But there are no other cost shares where you would pay for depredation losses or anything like that through your Game and Fish funds?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Eberle, other than that food plot that I was talking about, we make an upfront payment. It's usually around the perimeter of an area, but again, it's in the spring of the year. So if we go a 10-acre food plot and the geese only eat 5, we only pay for 5, you get to harvest the rest.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Mike Johnson with North Dakota Game and Fish Department.
Morning.
Thank you. Let me talk a little bit about the spray you were talking about. Most of that stuff is still unproven. It's very expensive. They tend to use it in urban areas on golf courses and real expensive small tracts of land that are being damaged by geese. This year we've tried some, working with the companies, done some experimental work. Not real rigorous experiments, but just trying it to see how it works. But it's as yet, I think, unproven. I'd call it unproven for use on agricultural crops. It's expensive. If it rains, you got to reapply it, and it's not something that's probably going to work, at least what we see right now. Regarding kill permits, this year we issued 225 kill permits to producers across the state. All they have to do is apply under the federal rules. They're required to demonstrate that they've used things other than killing the birds first, like the propane cannons, electric fences, scare devices, whatever. There's a whole list of them. So we have USDA staff go out and inspect their area, advise them on what the best techniques are. Once USDA inspector signs off on it, we'll issue a permit. Usually we get it to them the same day or next day. We can even, we fax it to them. The permit allows them to kill adults and goslings and destroy nests and eggs. And they have to do the adult and gosling killing with shotguns. Eggs can be taken out in a number of ways. The nests can be destroyed however they want. The permit is limited to 30 geese, but if they fill that quota, just get in touch with us. We send them another permit right away. We have a number of producers that get a number of permits, so that's not a problem. Very often we hear the producers want to use rifles. We've resisted using rifles for safety reasons and because they don't have a deterrent effect. If you sit and plink at geese and wound them 200-300 yards away, you're not going to really deter them from using those crops, taking those crops. In addition, the federal rules require that these birds have to be picked up and disposed of so they don't cause diseases such as botulism or other issues. So if you're shooting at birds across the lake 300-400 yards away, the chances of recovering those birds and disposing them are pretty slim too. So those are some of the basics on the permit. Are there other questions about those?
Representative DeCray, okay.
On the disposal, what does that entail? Do you mean, is it burying, burning again? I mean, most people say, well, the coyotes will take care of them, but...
Right, Mr. Chairman and committee members, under the federal rules, they have to be collected. They can't be left laying on the landscape. They have to be buried or burned, or they can be collected and donated to a charitable organization for food if somebody wants to do that. Those are the rules we're working under, so...
Representative DeCray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Terry. If this committee would to have drawn up and put forth a bill to the next legislative session to expand the number of counties, maybe even statewide for the August hunt, would the department support that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeCray, depending on how the bill looked, yeah. I would say on a general statement, yes, we would like to see it fashioned somewhat after the spring snow goose season where there is a charge, an extra charge, like $50 for non-residents, which would help pay for a better survey instrument also.
Thank you, Terry. Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
Continue.
If we would put forth a motion like that, could you work with council then so that we could put a bill together that wouldn't need much, if any, work when it got to the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeCray, absolutely. I would caution, you're going to have some members of the hunting, resident hunting public that will not agree with it.
Further questions? Oh, Representative Hunsker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, does increasing the bag limit help in controlling the Canada goose population, because farmers are busy? It's that time of the year where probably people just don't go out hunt when it's 80 degrees outside. Or do you have to go to other areas to control other than hunting? So the basic question is, does increasing the bag limit put more hunters out there and address the situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunsker, again, I'm going to defer to Mike. He spent an awful lot of time working on this. It's a combination of issues. The depredation tools that we have, the number of hunters out in the field, the bag limit. I will let Mike, though, because I know he's done some work, and we do argue with the Fish and Wildlife Service on some of these issues on an annual basis.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, regarding the bag limit, yes, increasing the bag limit can have some positive impacts, but you don't get a one-for-one return. You double a bag limit, you don't double the harvest. That's for certain. This year we did, for the early season, the August-September season, we did get approval from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to go to a bag limit of 15 birds a day. That's in place right now. It started August 15th, and hunters are out there rigorously attacking those birds right now. We usually see a a first season effect in those kind of changes. When you make a significant change to regulations, you see a peak in harvest and activity, and then it drops off in years afterwards. You just see, when you have a kind of a novel regulation, people go out to try to take advantage of it, and then the interest slacks off. But to maybe see where you're going, get where you're going with this, increasing the harvest is certainly needed. We've done about what we can. We are still working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get an increase in the regular season on Canada geese. We've tried for several years now and have not been successful, but we think that by next year we should be able to have 5 Canada geese in the regular season, which is kind of unprecedented. For many years, we were at 1 Canada goose. They were pretty rare. So we're hoping to go to 5 next year, which should help. Regular season also takes a lot of migrant Canada geese also. So what we really need is more hunters and some way to improve access to the land where they can get at these geese. Hunters are still having problems getting access to land, even from producers that are having problems with geese for whatever reasons. And it's maybe not necessarily a permission aspect, but it may simply be they can't always get in touch with the landowner one way or another. They're not living on the land as much as they used to. They're more difficult to get a hold of, those sorts of things. They're not in a phone book, they got cell phones. You know, all these kinds of issues come into play. But having more hunters, more hunting activity in addition to increasing the bag limits are ways we can go about increasing harvest.
Senator Bowman.
Mr. Chairman, sir, I'm not a goose hunter. I tried that once, and I tried to eat one once, and that took care of my goose hunting experience. But the question that I have, if I remember right, you had to get a federal waterfowl stamp? And the question that I have, if it's a federal waterfowl stamp, are all states, do they all tell you how many birds you can kill in each state? So it's the same all the way down, because it's being regulated by the federal government, evidently, because they collect the money. Do you have the flexibility of increasing that or decreasing the number based upon the population and the damage that's being done?
Essentially, we don't. Canada geese are a migratory bird. They're regulated by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, federal government. Canada geese, all geese, are managed on the basis of populations. There's a number, I think there's 13 different Canada goose populations across North America. And within the United States, within each population, regulations are similar, regulated by the service. So the Arctic nesting geese that come through the eastern part of the Central Flyway all have the same regulations in all the states. When you go to a different population, they'll have different regulations in those states. And it's based on population management, and each population has an agreed upon management plan between the states, the provinces, United States and Canada. There's an agreed upon management plan that basically sets out how these geese will be managed. And that's just the way it is with migratory birds.
Representative Rust, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You referenced needing more hunters. Can you tell me, has the number of hunters been increasing in the last, say, 15 years, staying about the same or decreasing?
Well, Mr. Chairman and committee members, let me pull out a graph here so I'm looking at the right. Our hunter numbers peaked in the mid-1970s, and then they dropped down. You see the graph there on your page. I think it's the second one on the front page. They dropped down in the late 1980s, early 1990s with the drought. We had an increase then into the early 2000s, and since those numbers have been dropping down. So, there's all kinds of ideas what the causes of these changes are. Certainly waterfowl populations and wetland conditions are one aspect of that, but there's all kinds of other sociological issues that go into whether somebody hunts or not, and I don't think we have time to go through all those now, although I certainly could.
Senator Triplett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Johnson. I'd like you to expand, if you could, on the last paragraph, on the last page of your report before the pages that have the graphs. Page 8, I guess it is. And just talk about how useful this information is or not. When you only have 37 questionnaires, that just seems, as Mr. Steinwein said, barely a statistically significant number. What's your confidence rate that this information you've provided us is modestly accurate?
Well, in terms of the, Mr. Chairman and Senator Triplett, in terms of those 37, the information from those 37 respondents, we're not very confident about that. It is a small sample size. In terms of our total harvest estimate, we've got some confidence intervals in the table there, so I think our total harvest estimate is pretty good. It's as good as we get. It's always difficult doing these human dimension surveys and getting reliable data. If you'd sit down with me and go through the surveys, you'd see how difficult it is. In terms of getting better information for non-resident hunters and where they hunt, especially in regard to special counties or something like that, we have to have a more targeted sample, and the best way to do that is issue them a special license so we have their name and address and we can survey those people directly. Without that, we're sending surveys to thousands of hunters, thousands of people that have no intention or experience in hunting geese. They're getting a questionnaire. You know, we're not getting responses, we're not getting good information. It's costing us a bunch of money to survey these people to get nothing. And if we had a targeted license that went to these people, like the spring snow goose license, then we could very easily sample 15% of those hunters and get very good information.
Follow up, if I may. Have you ever considered something that would like entice them to answer, like if you wanted a response from a particular population, like, you know, set the hunting fees higher in the first place and then offer them a third of their fee back sort of a rebate if they return their survey or something? I mean, if you really are interested in getting data, or are you only interested because the legislature told you to get this data? Is this something that's useful to you and that you'd like to have, or are you just like following the directive of the legislature?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Triplett, we have considered that, and that has been done in some places in human dimensions work, but basically the human dimensions experts will tell you it's not a good idea to offer enticements for data, because it severely can bias the responses and what you get. We also have ways of going into the data, and we have to correct for memory and prestige bias, because we know they don't tell us the truth all the time anyways. We see responses that are typically in multiples of bag limits. We see them avoid reporting the number 13 and the number 7. We have to adjust for those kind of things. It's probably not a good idea to offer enticements for responding to questionnaires.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Chairman. I'm just trying to remember, when was steel shod introduced? I know that's not going to change, but...
That came, I think it was 1987. 88, right in there, that it came into play. But these same kind of, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator, Representative Anderson, these same kind of changes have taken place across the country and in Canada even before steel shot regulations went in place up there. A lot of it has to do with the grain of America. The kids play their little electronic games and they don't live on farms anymore. The de-ruralification of America, people living in cities, the single-parent families. I mean, we've looked at this a lot, and there's a lot of different issues out there, and we don't have good answers for any of them.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Representative Anderson. I was just looking at that steel shot when we all started swearing when we had to use that, you know. Isn't nearly as lethal or as effective at range, but
as an avid goose hunter, maybe spent too much time of my life out in the field, just a quick question for you. Of the 13 subspecies of Canadians, these are by and large the extra fuel tank on the wings. These are the graters, right, that we're talking about? Do we have any other native subspecies?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, depending on which taxonomist you talk to, there's anywhere from 8 to 130 different races of Canada geese. They're all the same species. In fact, some taxonomists have now split Canada geese into two distinct species, which is a very difficult issue. But generally, most of us believe there's about 11 races of Canada geese. A race is, they're like different breeds of dogs. You have all dogs are the same species, but then you have labs and short hairs and setters and those kind of things. They're different races. They all look the same, generally with black necks and gray, white bodies, but they vary in size and shape. And what we see is in North Dakota on the prairies, there's one race of Canada geese at Estes. That's the giant Canada goose, the one we have here now. We have three other races that migrate through here. The interior Canada geese, which nest north of the prairies in central Canada. And then we have two races that come out of the Arctic, the little tiny Hutches and the Parvipes, which some people don't even think exist. But those are not a separate population that migrate from the Arctic to winter on the Gulf Coast. So we have four races and three populations that we deal with here in North Dakota in terms of management.
Representative Brandenburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to the special permit. How does that apply? Does that just apply to the landowner, or can that somebody else come out and assist you? Because, I mean, I'm a landowner, and I'm so busy finishing seeding my beans. I'm so busy spraying. I'm so busy that there's no time to go out and do some hunting. I mean, it's not about the cost of the whatever. Just explain that a little bit, if you could.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Brandenburg, we understand that. We hear that a lot. We're very well aware of that. In fact, my daughter farms over by Cleveland, and she's got her name on one of these permits, too. So, what we allow is basically anybody can get on that permit for the landowner. Needs to sign up himself as a landowner, but then he can have people that work for him. We've had people sign up, their friends who are hunters from Minnesota will come over and shoot geese. Recognize that this isn't hunting. They're not allowed to use hunting techniques in this kill. They can't use blinds and decoys and calls, but they can kill birds, and then they can donate them to the local church if they want or whatever. But yeah, a lot of landowners will get help from whoever's working for them or with them or was willing to come out and do it. And we have, I don't know, 6 or 8 spaces on a permit, but if somebody wanted more, we don't have a problem letting them sign up more. We do recognize, if I may, we do recognize that these permits have been kind of a paper burden on farmers and producers. And we're looking at ways to improve that, to make it much easier. In fact, I haven't even talked to Terry about this yet, but some of us within the department are trying to figure out how we can make this much more efficient. Maybe sign on the internet. You can do it at night then. You don't have to deal with paper. And maybe once you get your land descriptions in, you don't ever have to re-enter that in future years, because it is kind of burdensome right now the way it is. So we're hopefully we can find a way to make this permit thing much more efficient for the producers. Okay. And for us.
Yep.
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, why couldn't they use hunting techniques?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathan?
Close enough.
That's under the federal rules that we operate under. It's not supposed to be hot. It's the depredation control.
But what's the thinking behind it? Well, what the?
Not make a sport out of it, I guess.
Okay.
Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of hate to say this, but it's a really dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I hear you say burn, bury, donate. Didn't hear the word eat in there. can the people hunt those on a permit, can they eat them?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Russ, no, under the federal permit, they're not allowed to. This isn't a hunting season, this is a depredation control season. Recognize that this takes place all over the country. These geese are a problem all over North America and places that they've been introduced in New Zealand and Europe, they're seeing the same problems. And we're not alone in this, and nobody has figured out a good solution, but these depredation control permits are something that nobody really wanted to see, but with the EIS that came along and all the problems, we were forced into it, and nobody really likes it. I know the producers don't like having to kill these birds and dispose of them, and the hunters certainly don't like it, but those are the rules of the game that we have to live with.
Thank you. I guess it wasn't such a dumb question after all.
What, is there a limit on the amount or the number of permits, did you say, kill permits?
Mr. Chairman, we are operating under a limit with the Fish and Wildlife Service that we have never achieved, and I'm confident that if we ever got to, I think it's 10,000 geese could be killed under these permits, and I'm confident that if we got to that limit, we wanted more, we could get it increased.
Would there be any light, well, that would be too simple. I was just going to ask if there would be a likelihood that a producer or landowner could, that we could approve a blanket approval for killing of 25 geese by any landowner that was experiencing depredation.
Mr. Chairman, under the current rules we're operating under, that's not possible. It has to be under, and we have to monitor it. Not only do we have to issue these permits, we have to serve, get information back to the landowners and report back to the Fish and Wildlife Service on how many birds were killed, how many nests and eggs were taken, and we also get estimates of some of the losses and those kind of things. And that's burdensome on the producer, we know, but again, that we have to get that information, and that's required under our permit that we get.
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, I'd asked Terry about the 48,000, if that was enough. If you could write the rules, I mean, in your estimation, what is the optimum number that should be taken out every year to keep up with the population?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathy, I have made some estimates on that. And you recognize that taking the birds out has to include the kill permits, the early season, our regular season, and then the harvest up and down the flyways. It's somewhat difficult to measure how many of our birds are actually being taken, but with a population of 415,000 birds in the spring, those aren't breeders. Those are how many birds are here in the middle of May. About half of those are probably breeding geese. I haven't done this with the 415,000, but I did it when we were down about 300,000. I estimated we had to take out about 150 to 200,000 birds a year just to be stable. Now recognize that you're looking at 48,000, that's just the early season. That's not counting the regular season or what South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska takes. We also have, for the interest of the committee, these geese molt migrate. They molt in the summer when they can't fly. They're flightless for 40 days during the time that the goslings are growing up. And they have to be at least 2 years old to nest. About three quarters of them breed when they're 3 years old. The unsuccessful breeders, the one that fails to have a successful nest, and the ones that aren't old enough to breed, generally go on a molt migration. And some of these birds will go clear to the Arctic in June and lose their feathers up there and then fly back here. At the same time, we have molt migrants coming here from Missouri and Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and they're spending the summer here. So there's this huge shift of this entire continental population of geese each year. We do have a project underway right now in the Central Flyway, which is the 10 states, including North Dakota, down to Texas and New Mexico to Montana, to band a lot more of these birds to try to figure out whose geese are where when, so we can somehow try to optimize the harvest of those birds. Because it doesn't do North Dakota a whole bunch of good to kill Iowa's birds.
Right.
At the same time, we may need to increase the harvest of our birds in Saskatchewan and at some point. So there's a lot to be learned in that. We're working real hard now to try to do that.
Senator Everly.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Johnson, what's the penalty for killing geese without a permit?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Everly, I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you that. I don't know. It's probably a federal violation, and I really don't. I don't deal with law enforcement. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Everly, Mike's pretty much right. There's two separate violations there, potentially. The first would be a state violation, would be taking of game out of season or illegal take. The federal statute, I'm not exactly sure, but it's very similar, that it's taking waterfowl or migratory bird out of season, and I do not know what the penalty is associated with that.
Representative Brandenburg.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I want to be legal here, so I'm going to throw a scenario at you, because me and my brothers were just too busy to take care of these geese. This real situation. And I'm sure between your family, you probably lost 50 acres of beans, which is a sizable amount. So if we took, I know some kids that love to hunt, they come and hunt on our land, and we set up a permit and worked with Brian down there to get that permit so that he could go out there and do it right. Is that permissible to do that? So we get and say, hey, come on out and help us out here and we'll leave and give them something for doing it. We just have, is that allowed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brandenburg, I assume you're talking on the depredation permit?
Right, yeah.
That's absolutely legal. Like Mike said, if they're included in that list, if you want to have a two-page list and it includes 20 high school boys, absolutely. But I would offer it's not a hunt.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We work with the local people there that take care of the game fish. I refer to Brian and you know what I'm talking about.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Terry, how long does it take you to get the permit? I mean, can you apply for the permit before you have a problem? Because like most farmers you see have a problem, you're going to take care of it in the next 10 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I apologize for wincing a little bit. I never know what question you're going to ask.
We all do that.
But no, you almost have to have some problems before. Like Mike described, Wildlife Services, we'll contact Wildlife Services. They'll go out and check it out and say, well, no, they don't have a goose problem, or they haven't tried anything else yet before we actually issue the kill permit. We're pretty liberal, but not quite that liberal.
I just, if you see a flock of geese out there, it's usually, within a matter of a day or two, they're going to eat most of them, and your problem's over. But if I would think that most farmers will chase them off their field right away.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, if I could add, if you've had previous problems in previous years, that would qualify. So you could just put in for it in that respect. And like Mike said, he kind of surprised me, but it's a nice surprise that we're trying to make this system a whole lot easier, so it just goes bang, 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 more efficient for the producer and more efficient for us.
Yeah, thanks, Terry.
Representative Rust.
Oh, thank
just hold off a minute. Did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, committee, if I could just add something. Yeah, if the producers that have had problems in previous years, we automatically send them the permit forms early in the year, before, March or something like that. So they can get those into us. They can go to the field with them in hand. It's the new folks that come on board that have to be visit with Wildlife Services. And I just wanted to add that this last year, it's not the only thing we do that Wildlife Services does. Last year, Wildlife Services issued 21,000 miles of electric fence that we paid for, that we issued to private landowners, 348 propane cannons, put up 39 fences, and 661 flags, and almost 15,000 of these cracker shells. So it's, Wildlife Services gets in there and tries to work with the producer and finds the most effective solution for them. A lot of these producers are having very good luck with these single-strand ribbon electric fences. In the right places, they work very well.
Representative Russ, no, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, I want to expand on Senator Eberle's question about what's the violation. My question is, who monitors and fines those people, or I shouldn't say fines those, but charges those people? Is it game wardens only?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rust, it could be a game warden, or it could be a federal agent. It just depends. Chances are we're not going to do anything other than talk to the landowner and say, please get a permit so you're legal and we don't have to visit you again. I can't say the same would happen on a federal agent. I would hope so. Actually, Rich Gross is a federal agent in charge in North Dakota. He's very, very good to work with.
Senator Eberle.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I heard you say there is a cost here for the electric fences and for some of the other things. Who do I tell my constituents to contact? Who, the most direct route to get that information to them?
Mike Johnson, Mike Szymanski of our staff, and Marissa, and I can never pronounce her last name.
Nowinski.
So if they would call him?
If they'd call the Game and Fish office. Well, if they'd contact Brian out of Edgley or someplace like that. And they'll contact the right person in the Bismarck office, yes.
All right, committee, further questions? Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
We'll move into our 1040 item. Presentation by Lynn Helms on potash resources and energy regulation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
For the record, Lynn Helms, Director, Department of Mineral Resources. I know a little bit about a lot of things, but these guys know a lot about potash, and so with your permission, I'm going to ask the state geologist, Ed Murphy, to give the presentation, and we have with us Ned Kruger. He's one of our newest employees at the Geological Survey. He's the one who's rewriting the subsurface mineral extraction rules for the department. I'll stick around if there are other energy questions, but with your permission, I'm going to turn it over to Ed and Ned.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Might have been easier to use the USB. Just about got it? That one's still in there.
That's not working too well, Mr. Chairman, not like I hoped it would. I thought maybe it would just sync right with. Yeah, I do have that, but I thought this might. I might have had to turn, maybe I needed to turn the computer off in order for it to sync to the.
It's okay. We realize that technology is no respecter of schedules. Yep, we'll do that. Yeah, let's take a 5-minute break and be back here at 11.
What I'll do is I'll turn it off and turn it on, and it should. I assume, Lynn, do I need to, that's what I think. I think I'm going to have to turn it off. Yep. Because that's not. There it goes. Oh, there we got it. Okay. I do know a little bit about a lot of things. I appreciate that, yeah. So how did you get that to function, F8?
Oh, okay.
You just keep toggling that until it works for both.
Okay.
Yeah. So what yours was set up just for the computer.
Okay.
It wasn't feeding the projector.
The one thing I can't wait for is when I look at this twice, the Java thing comes up to re-update. Yes, and I was trying to do some things, but I think it's
going to... Martel look at it?
Well, I don't look at it.
Is that what this is right now?
Oh, that's the Norton antivirus wanting to update too. Hopefully that won't be a problem, but it's like, thank you. Sync with your thing, but it will, you know.
Well, I just thought I could point with the...
You can point with this, can't you? I hope. There. See? This thing right here, you can point. And then what's this right here? I don't want to... Can I just see if it moves your thing forward?
Well, I took the thing out. Oh, see, okay. I can just get it to...
Gotcha.
To advance. I'm thinking that...
And then for our tour of the Grand Forks next week,
yep.
You know, I cut it down to an hour and a half. That's the time I allotted from 1 to 2:30.
That's fine.
I think it's enough time to do the tour, get back there. I mean, right. It's realistic,
yep.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we can do that. And, in fact, I'll work on... I'll start working on the...
We should eat before that, but they might even be able to be over at your place at 1 o'clock because we're going to eat from 11:45 to 1. Well, they'll be done early, so they can walk over. Or, you know, we might start right at 1.
And I've got the van just in case because, okay. As I say, it is... It's a nice walk, but it's a dangerous walk because kids are late for class and they're trying to find a parking spot. And so it's...
And it's a good idea because you have people like Senator Andrews that's having some difficulty walking and things like that. But it might just be a good idea to haul one or two over.
Plus, I took my 15-passenger test so I could...
I just told him I was... I had experience on a farm and was a... I was a limo driver for about 3 years, so they just waived the test.
Actually, the very first time I ever drove a van in my life was a UND van. When I was in school, we drove down to New Mexico. And I remember in Utah pulling out, because I was like third van, so I had to keep up with the professor, and I pulled out. And I had a long stretch, and I just barely got in before a semi got in, because it, you know, they just don't have much for acceleration.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah.
It,
Yeah, the only people that have those are universities and homeschoolers.
Right, yeah.
My brother has one. He's got a bunch of kids and he homeschools. And so
it is very different to drive.
Yeah, they are. It's different.
Interesting how the test emphasized, which I had never thought about, but that the more people you have in, the higher the center of gravity goes. And so the more chances for it to tip over. And empty, because you'd almost think, yeah, an empty van would be more, but they said, hell, the more people, the more chance. So I remembered a few things anyway from that.
Call the meeting back to order and continue with our presentation by State Geologist Ed Murphy. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize for this little bit of glitch, but we'll get going. You may recall when I was here in April, had a number of questions on the EB well, the latest potash well, and I could not respond to those. And it wasn't until last Monday, August 13th, that well went off tight hole. We have quite different rules than oil and gas does for this program. So with that, I'd like to go through and give you some background. Also, JT Starzecki is here from the company, and so he can certainly fill in any gaps that I leave or give some insight. Just again to kind of some background that I did present back in April. Potash is just a general common name for the potassium salts. I did want to point out a couple of mineral names: sylvite, which is potassium chloride; sylvanite, which is a mixture of potassium chloride and sodium chloride, table salt; and then carnallite, which is a potassium magnesium salt. And as you know, potash is used primarily for fertilizer. The area in green in northwestern North Dakota is the extent of the prairie formation. And once again, you may recall the prairie formation is where the potash layers or zones are located. And so what I've plotted here on this map are the five potash exploration wells that have been drilled in North Dakota to date. I color code these a little bit so you can see the TXL well in Burke County was the first potash exploration well drilled in the 1960s. Then in the mid-70s, 76 to 77, there were three different potash wells drilled. As you can see, two in Burke County and the other in southwestern Botno. And then in 2010, the EB well was drilled. And so I'm going to be talking about the EB well, comparing it to the TX well, which is in very close proximity. And then I'm going to go all the way over to Botno County and compare it to the Helming well. Again, I showed this map before when I was here. This, again, is the extent map of the prairie, but what's different, we've kind of color-coded, and what's contoured is the depth to the top of the prairie formation. So you can see over in Botno County, only 6,000 feet down to the top of the prairie. You get down into Williams County, and it's down to 12,000 feet as you get going into the center of the Williston Basin near Watford City, and that's why these beds are dipping in that direction. This is actual core from the EB well. I realize it's a little bit hard to see here, also on the handout, at depths of 8,856 feet to 8,873. We have yet to sit down and go through these. We kept everything boxed up until last Monday, but we'll be going up in the next week or so and taking a look at this. And a very good core. We're very pleased with the core they were able to obtain. And this is another segment of that core down to 8,898 feet. Now, this is the core analysis from the EB well. The depths over on the left coincide with core depths. So we're going from 8,810 feet to 8,893. And you'll see the same. I'm going to be interchanging this graph with other material, but that scale on the left side will always stay the same for the EB well. So this is the percentage of potassium oxide. It also can be reported as potassium chloride, and you'll see that interchangeably in the industry. This is, so you can see the potassium oxide content ranges from just a few percent in some of these analyses all the way up to over 40%. Then again, I mentioned carnallite early on, which has that magnesium component. When you plot the carnallite percentage against this, you see that it ranges again from a low of a few percentage all the way up to over 60%. And generally, companies that are looking for potash, strictly for potash, try to avoid carnallite. And often the processing plants that are processing for potash will only take or set up to take carnallite less than 6%. This is then laying those two graphs side by side. Again, I realize it's probably hard for you to read, but what I want to do now is go back in. You can do weighted percent for layers where you add up the different analyses and take the distance between those and multiply them and then divide by the total thickness. That gives you a weighted percent. So we can divide two of those zones into two layers. The first one is 6.3 feet thick, and it has a weighted potassium oxide percent of 18, and then the layer below it, 5.3 feet thick, at 24%. And you know, JT has some real insight as to what companies look for at different depths, but we've gone into the Canadian literature and some of the literature throughout the world trying to piece this together, and we're kind of in the beginning of this process. And I'll mention a little bit later, the report that we'll be working on shortly will focus on this to a much more degree, but generally what I saw in the Canadian literature is that they were after thicknesses of say 4 meters or so, you know, over 12 feet, and then potassium oxide percentage running anywhere from 20 up to 25%. So we're not real far off, and in fact, what you can do then is also recalculate this to one layer, and there you come up with a layer that's 13.9 feet thick. But in doing so, then the overall potassium oxide weighted percent drops down to 18%. And if we do the same for carnallite for that same zone, then we're looking at almost 17% carnallite. Okay, now I want to compare this to the adjacent, the EB well to the adjacent TXL well, only a mile and a half south. Again, the EB well was drilled 1 mile north of Lignite and 2 miles east, and the TXL well is almost directly one mile east of the town of Lignite. Here on the right is the EB well, the gamma log, and over on the left is TXL. I just put those up to show what I'm using as background, and then we went through and laid the potash layers on there. So the TXL well has 12 potash layers within the prairie formation, and if you add up the thickness of all those layers, it's 55 feet of potash. If you go over to the EB well, 6 potash layers for a cumulative thickness of 18 feet. So you can see quite a difference in both the number of layers and the cumulative thickness of potash within just a mile and a half of each other. Now I want to go over, and I should mention, of the four potash exploration wells drilled in Burke County, they're all within 13 miles of each other, so a rather localized area. Now we jump over to near Lansford in southwestern Bottineau County, about 50 miles away. And here now is the Helming well in Bottineau County, and I think you can see right away the potassium oxide percent jumps up. You've got, again, analysis that came back with just a few percent, but now others that, that came up over 40 and actually over 50%. And the carnallite now is less than 0.5%. So much, much lower the carnallite percent. Now we'll go back in and do the same thing we did the EB well. We can do a weighted percent, break these into layers, and now we've got a layer that's 12.5 feet thick with a weighted average of potassium oxide of 21%. So certainly that would fit in to one of the zones that the Canadians look at for economics. And then the lower zone below that is 11.3 feet thick, but only 4% potassium oxide. And then again, when you plot that over, you can see now the weighted percent of carnallite is anywhere from 0.5% to down to about 0.3, so very low. This is a cross-section we ran across using some of the, two of these. Here's the TXL well and the EB well, but the rest of these are from oil wells that were drilled that penetrated the prairie formation. And here's the one of those potash zones, the Belle Plaine coming through here. It's thinning a little bit to the west. And then here's the Esterhazy below that, that's, we can see thinning and thickening. Again, it's hard to see, but what I want to do is talk a little bit more about this generalized cross-section. So these are all five of the potash exploration wells have been drilled in North Dakota. We're going from west to east. Again, to the far left is a TXL well, then the EB well, and then we go through the Wilson Ewing, also those in Burke County, and then over to Bottineau for the Helming well. Everything in gray is the prairie formation, so if it's in gray, that means it's halite, it's table salt. And again, the blue layers then are potash, they're potassium salts. So you can see how variable they are from well to well, especially we see the large number in the TXL and then the numbers dropping, but somewhat more consistent with the Wilson, although those zones were thicker, and then over to Ewing and Helming. One thing I want to point out is that the reason I compared the Helming well to the EB well, those are the only two wells that we have detailed core analysis on. Unfortunately, for the Wilson and the Ewing, we've got core descriptions where somebody looked at the core and then noted it, and in some cases they noted carnallite, but we never had the percentage, and those cores were then lost over time. We never received those. The only two cores that we have in the core library in Grand Forks is a TXL well and now the EB well. So it comes down to what do we learn from the EB well, and one of the first things that caught our attention was the carnallite, because again, we had the detailed analysis of the Helming where the carnallite was very, very low. And here the carnallite tends to be not on the real high end, but on the higher end, certainly above the 6% that the potash people tend to look at. But we see that it's variable across North Dakota, and it's variable probably within a very short distance. It may be more localized. And certainly in comparing the TXL well to the EB well, we see that the thickness of the potash zones and the number of potash layers can change very quickly. The real positive part about this, and we said this going in, is that it was disappointing that in the four previous wells we really only had, we had core from one well, we had analysis from the other well that we didn't have core from, and now this is the first time we've got good analysis, the core, and the logs altogether. There's another wrinkle to this, and I was talking to JT about this meeting, that we ran across a company called Carnallite Resources, and they were doing drilling last year and again this year near Wynyard, Saskatchewan, north of Regina, and they're actually going after carnallite. Carnallite, if you look at potash deposits around the world, there's quite a bit of potash that's actually mined from carnallite because that's what they have available. There's some additional costs involved if you're trying to remove the magnesium. But also magnesium is used in aluminum alloys and other things, so there are uses for that. And that's what this Carnallite Resources out of Weyburn is looking at specifically, is to mine and remove the magnesium for use in other manufacturing. So I want to talk a little bit about rules, but I want to tell you what we're going to be doing now. As soon as we get the rules process done, Ned, who Lynn introduced, has been working full-time on our rules. As soon as that is done, he's going to go full-time into creating a new potash report for Northwestern North Dakota, and it'll turn out to be the most detailed report that we've done. And we have companies and investment companies that are going to probably sit back and wait for us to come out with that report. Probably the biggest result of the EB well is if they'd hit 50 feet of solid sylvite or sylvanite, we probably would have generated a little more interest. And instead now, I think companies are realizing what we've realized for quite a while, is that you can't come in and just drill one exploration well. You're probably going to need to come in and drill anywhere from 6 to 12. Maybe not your company specifically, but one company I would hope would come in and drill 6 holes to help us get a better handle on the potash in North Dakota. Again, we're comparing 5 exploration wells to thousands of exploration wells in Saskatchewan. And so that's what it's going to take for us. And hopefully the work that we're going to be doing, that Ned's going to be doing between now and the report will probably be out in about 12 months, we're going to try to point companies in areas that they should be looking at. And I think one of those certainly is Western Bottineau County, and even coming a little bit over towards Renville, where the potash zones are still a little bit shallower. They tend to also thin as you go to the east, which is kind of unfortunate, but you might be able to find a zone in between where they're a little bit shallower depth and thicker and with a lower carnalite percent, unless the company is focusing at going after that carnalite. So with that, I'll just wrap this up by talking about where we're at with subsurface mineral rules. That program is all-inclusive, and it's been in effect since 1968. It's the Administrative Code 430202. It's 17 pages long, which would be adequate for, I think, for a lot of programs, but that covers the EB well. We permitted that under that program as an exploration well. Had they gone forward and drilled other exploration wells and gone to a solution mine, we would also cover that under that program. It covers a shallow test hole drilling for anything from clay to uranium to gold, pretty much everything other than coal, which we have under a different program. And you may recall about, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, we actually pulled uranium solution mining out of this chapter, created a separate one, and that alone is 58 pages, that the 430202.2. And then it also includes surface mining for non-coal. So Ned has been working since December on this, and at one point this had ballooned up to 500 pages. He's gotten it down to 90 pages. And it's out to the Health Department and Public Service Commission for their review. It'll be going to our attorney. And again, this is really small, but I just wanted to point out that we plugged this into a timetable. If we're able to get everything to our attorney by October 1st, or the responses, her responses back, we could go to the Industrial Commission in October. We should make the Administrative Rules Committee meeting March 10th to the 15th. They're going to meet sometime in that time span. And then the rules would become effective April 1st. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I guess the one other comment I would make, just to reiterate, so I think that the people we've talked to, the companies that are interested in following potash, are probably going to wait for our report, so that's a year down the road. If they were to drill exploration wells right after that, that would probably be a year to set that program together, so then we're 2 years out right now. And then if they found an area that really looked promising, they would need to come in and probably drill another half dozen wells just in that area. So the for somebody to come to us with a potash solution mine permit, I would think would be a minimum of 3 to 4 years out right now. And with that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Committee Representative Hunsker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, you talked about the Helming well. Two questions. What direction is that from Lansford and how far? And then the second one, those are the shallower ones? And did you say that the amount and the quality of the potash in the shallower ones is significantly more, say, than the EB well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunsker, I can give you the exact location of that. I didn't bring that with me, but it's close. It's, I think it's within, certainly within 6 miles. It might be a few miles closer. And what happens, as we've seen with the information that we've got, and every time an oil well went through and drilled to, like, the Winnipegosis or the Red River, they were drilling through the prairie. We've got those logs, and so we've used that to do some correlation. We found a method where he can go in and do some more detailed comparison of those logs and give us more information on the potash than we have right now. But in general, what happens, the potash zone, because the prairie becomes shallower as you go to the east, then eventually, if you remember that first map, it's actually cut off, and both by non-deposition and later solution mine or solution also. So the salt is gone by the time you get to, say, central Bottineau County. But there's also a tendency for those potash layers, as the entire formation is thinning, those potash layers are also thinning. But as I showed there, I mean, there was an example where you're over 12 feet thick and you're at 24-25% potassium oxide. So that in itself may be economic, and that's one of the things we're going to have to be looking at. The Canadians point to something like that as being economic. JT will tell you, again, it's very depth dependent, and also it might be they're pointing to one bed, and you might need multiple beds in order for that. Maybe you need two or three at that same thickness and quality for it to be economic. We'll have that answer certainly in a year.
Representative Steiner.
How does this mine look? Is it, are you going to have one surface drilling unit? And how's it going to look to the public? And do they actually, does it look like a lignite mine? Are you going to do it underground? And how does it look?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Steiner, I'll just forward right through, and if I may, and just show you. Here is Mosaic's plant up in Belle Plaine, Saskatchewan. This is the world's largest solution mine for potash. And so that, you're looking at the facility itself, and then it has a series of cluster wells around here. Here are, these are paired. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paired wells on one pad. Those are going down. You know, again, we've been talking about 6,700 feet over in Bottineau County, 9,000 feet in Burke County. They're at 5,500 feet here in Saskatchewan. Because of the shape of the Williston Basin, and then they're going into another basin up there called the Elk Point Basin, their salt deposits are shallower. And to the point where if you go up north of, like in the Saskatoon area, north of Belle Plaine, north of Regina, they're actually underground mining those at depths of 3,000 feet.
Continue.
What is our bond that we have for protection? Do we have that? We've already got the bond set, I would assume.
For Mr. Chairman, for the exploration well that Dakota Salt said, it was $50,000, and we're still holding that bond. For if you went to, and here's another diagram of the site. Here's the processing plant here, and here are these cluster sites spread across. This is 1 mile square here. The we will have a staging. We will be looking at in our draft rules. We will be looking at everything, much as we did for uranium ISL, where you look at what are the costs of the buildings to remove those, what are the costs of cleanups. Certainly would be in the millions of dollars for the bond. But we'll have a formula that will be calculated. And then every year we'll revisit that to make sure that, you know, if they're adding things that will, because you'll have to figure a bond to plug every single one of those wells.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple questions. I know you have to use water when you mine this, and where would you find the supply of water, and how much do you need?
Mr. Chairman.
If you can answer that, please.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the initial problem of getting water is a startup, but once you do that, you're using brines, because you want the water that's going down to be totally saturated with sodium chloride so that it preferentially dissolves out the potassium chloride. If you were to put fresh water down, you would just dissolve all the table salt, all the sodium chloride first, and then you're recycling that water. And I forget what the, to be honest, between uranium ISL, we were recycling at 97%. I don't remember where this would be at that same percentage, but there certainly would be some water usage, but you're not putting down a fresh supply of water every single time.
Continue.
Oil wells, you know, that they use that is contaminated with salt, or?
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson. In fact, I just used the word fresh, which I shouldn't have used. I meant new waters. But that's exactly what you would be using. Water that otherwise would be going down a saltwater disposal well would be used to as a water supply.
Thanks.
Further questions, committee? Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Murphy, you mentioned your schedule. Are the 90 pages of the current version of the regulations online yet or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, no, they're not. It's still internal. And first we'll have to, after we go through on our attorney, because one of the questions we're trying to decide is if we shouldn't split this into four different chapters or sections, because right now they're all into one, and it's very difficult, I think, for people to try and navigate through, and especially now as we're going to be greatly expanding it. But and to be honest, we haven't done rulemaking for a little while. We've got to go through our industrial commission, get their approval. Once we go out for a public hearing, then they will be posted on our website, and then there'll be 30 days. I forget what the notice time is, and then they'll be on for 30 days comment period.
So if I may continue, you'd expect that to be somewhere in the January, February timeline? Your timeline kind of ended in December, so just when do you think they'll be available for public comment?
Right now, November, so it would be out in October for comment period.
Further questions? So in all likelihood, any real action is 4 or 5 years down the road as far as mining?
Mr. Chairman, that is my impression at this time. As I said, if this had been phenomenal results from the EB well, I think that would have spurred other drilling by potentially that company as well as other companies. And we might be looking at a different scenario right now. But certainly what's not changing is, as the world's economy recovers and the demand for potash will continue to grow.
Looks like you've answered all the questions. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
I guess we probably have to discuss both issues. Well, we have time for committee discussion. You want to discuss this one? Okay, Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we on to potash? Are we going to discuss the first issue?
Do you want to go back to the first issue and work on that, or do that after we discuss potash?
I'm looking to you to tell me which one it is. If we want to talk about potash, that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit.
Well, let's finish up the subject of potash, and then we will go back and discuss the first presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I guess as a committee, is it our charge to look at the taxation element of mining potash? Or is it up to this committee to come up with a recommendation or some direction or something in regard to that?
I'll refer to council on that, but I do think our directive was to deal with the tax issue here, but...
Chairman Damshin, Representative Rust, our study was to study potash mining. In the bill that created that study also, it was the intent of the 62nd Legislative Assembly that the 63rd Legislative Assembly provide a source of up to $2 million for loans for potash development impacted political subdivisions. In addition, in that bill, and is in the law in section 57-65-07, the tax collected as provided by this chapter is appropriated and must be apportioned as determined by the 63rd Legislative Assembly. One could imply that that was the reason for this study, was to look into allocation and impact funding. Part of that, though, was based on the assumption that potash mining would happen within 3 to 5 years of last session. We've heard testimony that it most likely won't happen next year. So you could recommend a solution now, or you could wait, but it will have to be dealt with by the next legislative assembly somehow, even if it's just to change the law to say the following legislative assembly besides this one looks at it. But I don't think there's the rush that there was at the beginning because of what we've heard today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern would be, again, a major concern would be for Burke County. It's a small populated county, and whatever happens with the mining of potash, that county needs to be taken care of with the impact that might come its way. You know, when I look at what's happening in oil country, and fortunately, you know, we have a state that I believe is, and a governor that's looking at trying to help those counties that are struggling with a burgeoning industry. If this were to happen, if you'd have not only oil exploration going on in Burke County, and you'd add potash exploration going on, you could have a county that could be with very few residents that would have a dramatic impact on them that they couldn't bear. And so whatever we do with regard to the taxation, whenever we deal with this issue, we really need to make sure that county is taken care of and that they aren't swamped with problems beyond what they're able to handle.
Further comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
I agree 100% with the previous speaker. I think the only thing is, for myself, we don't know what that cost is. And until we actually get to mining and find out what the actual impact is, whatever we do, there's got to be flexibility so we don't end up with the same thing as we ended up with oil, where we're way short of funding what's necessary to keep that industry going to our political subdivisions. I don't know when we'll get that information or how long it'll take to get it, but we do have to have some flexibility to allow the state to recognize that and to generate the resources to take care of that problem. That's just my personal feeling from the experiences I've had.
Well, it almost seems like we need something in place that says, you know, the local infrastructure is going to be supported, and at least not left out when the industry in the local area provides as much to the state as it does, whether it be oil or potash or
yeah.
whatever it is. And I'm not sure it's even set up that way for agriculture, but I mean, we have some of those growing pains as the industry changes, but we do need something in place, I think, as maybe a general provision that addresses that issue with these industries coming in, which we're all thankful for and I'm certainly supportive of. But we can't do it at the expense of the local people and local government subdivisions. And I think that's kind of what your concern is. I mean, whether it's Burke County or Botno County or Cavalier County.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is. For the most part, other than the one well in Botno, it looks like it's kind of Burke County kind of seems like it's going to be the epicenter and of this if it takes off. And that's, I do not mean to slight Botno County or other counties. The other part of that is that as their representative, I need to speak for them. Okay.
That's your...
Mr. Chairman?
Designated duty there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Boyd.
I think that if something is written up, it should also be inclusive to other minerals that potentially could be developed, like we have an uranium down in southwestern North Dakota that they talked about someday, and I think that same set of rules should be inclusive to include any other minerals where there could be a possible impact to a political subdivision.
I agree, Senator. I mean, 15 or 20 years ago, we didn't foresee the issues that we're facing today. Comments? Council, do you have a recommendation for the committee? Anybody on the committee have a desire how to take action, or should we, is our recommendation that we need more information on the industry before we really make any concrete decision other than we, do we all agree that we need to address the issues that come up for the local political subdivisions regardless of the industry, but in this case especially potash? I guess maybe we have a consensus about that.
Mr. Chairman, to refresh my memory, in the last legislative session, we did not the law address that the property would be taxed for property tax purposes? Okay, and did we have any kind of a taxation method in that law? Seems to me we did, but it was pretty, if I remember right, it was kind of meager. Is that a correct assessment or not?
Council, do you have...
Chairman Damshin, Representative Rust, the amount of the taxation changed greatly throughout the session. I think it started off at 5 and 5 and ended up at 2 and 4. I think it was,
Silence is deafening.
Mr. Chairman, probably the silence is deafening because we're probably trying to figure out what something's going to do when we don't know what the something is that's doing it.
Well, I think that's exactly true. I mean, I think we're limited and what action we can take, as limited as we are by information. And the experts are telling us they need more information. If I'm hearing you right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
My thinking is that, is there some way we could write something that would allow the Industrial Commission, if there's an impact that happens between sessions, and it's a huge impact, the Industrial Commission could recognize that impact and some way make a decision in our budget section then could approve that, so that immediately we could try to get some restoration back to those political subdivisions wherever. I don't know if that would work or not, or maybe it's not the right way to go, but at least it would open the door for whenever a company decided to come in, the political subdivision there is not left out. There is a mechanism in place then that would direct where this could take place and how it would work.
Is that something we can do? In your opinion, Counsel?
Chairman Damshin, the committee can do, of course, whatever it likes. If a bill draft was to be done, it would take, in good conscience, two more meetings, and could be done in one more meeting. I would guess this issue will be addressed during the session as well, with a mechanism that will address these issues. The other thing is from listening to the testimony today, even if it wasn't addressed this session, it could be addressed the session after that and still not be too late. So there is time to come up with a great solution instead of patching something together right now that may be great or may not.
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't totally disagree with Senator Bowman's line of thinking, but I think, you know, anytime we can get more information on what's going on is good, but I think we heard today that it's going to take 3 to 4 years, really, before something really happens up there. And we really don't know what the impacts are to the subdivisions until it actually happens. Now, I'm all for being proactive and getting something set up, but I think for the interest of this committee, I think we have time to get more information and kind of let things play out up there, see what the test wells come up and see what the information that the industry has gathered, and then we can build off of that and come up with something with the political sub. So I guess my thinking would be, I think we have time to wait. As the council said, we have till next session, and that'd be my thinking.
If we could just carry these thoughts forward to the session, you know, and Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the audience is Mr. Starzecki. Would it be appropriate to ask him if he has any new information for us that might be good for him to give?
I don't see any problem with that. Would you like to share anything?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is J.T. Starzecki with Sirius Minerals. At this particular point in time, we really don't have anything new to share other than some of the findings that are on our website and have been made public in regards to the different regional studies that we've done over the last year. All of our focus has been on our United Kingdom project in the last 12 months, so we really don't have anything from a project perspective. But I'm happy to answer any industry-related questions that might be out there. We've got a pretty extensive market research department, so we follow all the trends.
Representative Rust.
Thank you. I'll try not to dominate this thing. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Starzecki, would you agree with the assessment of the previous speaker here about 3 to 4 years out at a minimum?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rust, I would, and I would even say that the potential for it to be longer is probably
is probably even a more accurate. So I know I had mentioned 3 to 5 years. It's probably that 5+ years. They're just, we tend to echo the sentiments that other players will wait for that report to come out and to really formulate an appropriate exploration plan. You're looking at 12 months plus, and there's just a lot that goes into an initiative of this nature. So yeah, it's a long term. It certainly is a long term timeline.
Representative Steiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Starzecki, what kind of price would move you to act really quickly? If you saw a price on the market, is there a certain price point that would really make your company come back to North Dakota and try and quickly do something?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Steiner, so much goes into the model of a project of this nature. Spot price for potash is one of many components that go into how we evaluate projects. Really, you know, our decision to focus on our United Kingdom project was an internal decision based off of the sheer and vast amount of data that was available on that project in the public domain. There were, you know, tens if not hundreds of well logs to be evaluated. We acquired over 250 kilometers of seismic data, and when you have a certain amount of capital, you have to make decisions internally, and our decision was based off of where we were going to spend our limited resources. And we took a project that had a lot of data that gave us a fairly high degree of certainty. And certainly the price of potash plays into it, but it's only one of many factors. And one of the things, as Ed pointed out, the layers that we encountered here are extremely deep. If you look at all the world's projects, it's one of the deeper projects out there. I mean, there's some stuff in Australia that we've done a lot of exploration work on, not drilling, but desktop work. And when you talk about 8,000 to 9,000 feet, that's extremely deep. Comparatively speaking, our United Kingdom project, the deepest we go is, you know, 1,400 to 1,450 meters, so shy of 5,000 feet. So very significant, and that additional depth adds a whole new layer of cost associated to it. So,
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just give me a timeline. So the time your company says, okay, we have a big press conference, we're coming to North Dakota, we're going to do this, how long until that plan is up and running? What I'm trying to get is when that impact hits that political subdivision. So from the time you announce, from the time that thing is with construction and everything else, from the time the thing is working, how long is that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathy, I want to be clear on one point. This is a general term. Yeah. This isn't Dakota Salts or Serious Mineral.
Ballpark is fine. Yeah.
Industry standards say from the time you go into exploration to the time you go into production is 5 years, minimum. In a lot of cases, it can be 7 or 8 years. It just depends on the output. So if you're looking at, as an example, our United Kingdom project, the first year we go into production right now is slated for 2017. We're looking at producing about 5 million tons a year. We started exploration in 2012, and we are fast-tracking everything. So best case scenario is 5 years. But you look at like the Jansen expansion, that could be up to 7 years just to build additional capacity into an already existing operation.
So your industry is waiting for more information on these studies, and once the studies come back positive, I mean, we're really in a company that says we're going to go. It's really another 5 years on top of that yet before they actually start production.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathy, I would say that as a general statement, that's fairly accurate. Sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, I do think we have plenty of time. I think we got plenty of time to wait and do our homework and come up with something. So,
Senator Brust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a difference between production and exploration? Because we all know that, you know, in the oil industry, it's basically the exploration phase that creates the impact. It's not the production phase as much, because by the time that gets online, you're getting your infrastructure and your pipelines and all that stuff into gear. So my question is, are we talking exploration 5 years, or are we talking production? Because there is a difference.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rust, in what we do in the potash business, there is a significant difference, solely based off the fact that potash as a component when it comes out of the ground is inherently
almost valueless. It has to go through an evaporation and a processing process. So therefore, as Mr. Murphy showed, the Mosaic mine, all the structure has to be built to actually manufacture that product, right? So evaporation or different types of production methods. So you can have an exploration program that has fairly minimal impact on the environment. Where additional impact comes into place is when you have a production facility that needs to be developed and manned, if you will.
Yes, Senator Burkhardt.
Thank you. What is your website?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Burkhardt, the best one to go to would be www.siriusminerals.com. We've got links to all of our subsidiary websites like Dakota Salts, but it has a direct link for all of our RNS feeds on that particular website, and that'll be the most true place for information, most accurate and
Thank
timely.
You.
Further questions for Mr. Tarzecki? Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, I think we've determined that the urgency of the issue is non-existent for this committee, although I think the concerns that have been brought up by Senator Bowman and Representative Rust and others that I don't know if we can make a recommendation that, or if it's even necessary. I mean, I think we do have a consensus, it seems like, that we need to be concerned for local subdivisions when industry steps in and blossoms, but I don't know how we approach it as a committee. Do you have a recommendation for that, or the process that we would typically follow for that?
Chairman Damshin, I think in the final report it's logical explaining what we've done and why we're waiting. It makes sense.
Do we need a motion?
No.
Okay. The committee agreed that that's the path to follow? I guess we have a consensus by the nod of the heads. Okay. Any other comments on the potash issue? We'll go back and try to finalize the goose issue. Representative DeCray.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. since this is sine die for this committee, we're really not going to be putting any bills or anything forward, and I think the goose problem has been very well identified by landowners on the committee that will be returning probably to the Standing Committee Natural Resources, and I would urge them to take their concerns and submit a bill and take care of it, because our time has ended and there's really nothing we can do.
Other comments? Just in visiting with some of you here during that short break, depredation is a problem not just with geese, but we happen to be dealing with the goose issue, but I think Representative DeCray's advice is sound advice. We need to address this in natural resources. It's right away. And maybe this is another subject where we can be more general, because we see blackbirds even becoming a serious problem, especially in corn country, sunflower seeds. Unless you see it, you probably can't believe the problems that some of this wildlife can cause. And we're not opposed to wildlife, but just can't afford to feed them. Any comments? I guess we did pretty well cover that. I think it would take one or two meetings for us to draft a bill on that subject as well. So do we want to make a recommendation as a committee? Will that be in the report?
Chair,
Chairman Damshin. That was a report that this committee was assigned to receive. It wasn't like a study where we had to make any recommendation on it. So just by receiving it, we've completed our duty.
Can we note Representative DeCray's?
Yes.
Recommendation. Any other comments? Well, Representative DeCray.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move sine die and that our report be forwarded to the full legislative council and presented at the pre-session meetings.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, committee members. We are adjourned and sine die.